The following episode of Faux Hop is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. Faux Hop advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to Faux Fop. And my guest today is someone who needs no introduction, unless, of course, you don't know who it is, in which case he does need an introduction. He's the man behind not only the Faux Fop Network, but also Hamish Nandy and his own wonderful podcast, 21st Century Boy. And what's the Harry Potter one called again? Harry Potter and the Boys? Is that right?
Harry Potter and the Boys. And I just quick correction. It's actually 20th Century Boy.
I'm thinking of the Bad Religion song. Sorry.
There's a lot of people make the connection wrong, but it's because I'm born in the 90s, and I feel like people who are born in the 90s are now like sort of, well, anyone born before 2000 now seems to be really old.
Yeah,
so that's kind of why I called it 20th century.
Oh, look, when it comes to giving podcasts bad names, like Faux Fop is probably up there with the worst. But then I had my own solo podcast for a while called That's Awesome, which was a play on a in-joke on Faux Fop. But that just became so confusing to people who weren't familiar with Faux Fop, because like, is the podcast called That's Awesome? Why have you misspelled awesome? And I'm like, no, it's a joke relating to my other podcast. But
it's a pun.
Yeah, it's a pun. But yeah, people wouldn't get that. And when you have to
I can't explain
the name of your, why you named your podcast a certain way, it's like having to explain a joke. As soon as you do that, you lose.
Yeah. Okay, so this is actually something, just to kick it off.
Yeah. Oh, this is podcast Mike, radio is, Mike Liberale, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I didn't complete
by the way, hey, guys. So this is actually, honestly, just to bring it up with you, and feel free to pass this on to Will.
Okay.
This has been the bane of my existence for a number of years now, because sometimes I actually avoid telling people that I work on Faux Fop only because the explanation of what it means is just so annoying. Like, and I don't even 100% understand it. Don't even get me started on Faux Fop. Like, the look of confusion people give me when I'm like, oh, tomorrow I'm recording a Faux Fop. And then they're like, well, I thought it was called Faux Fop. I'm like, nah, so Charlie worked on Home and Away for a bit, and then Will started another one called Faux Fop, as in fake Faux Fop. And it is just so difficult to explain to people the podcast network that is Faux Fop, but I think I'm doing a good job of it now.
Yeah, it is hard to explain. And it's also, it's kind of like we never expected it to get this far. Like, I think if we knew that podcasts were going to become as popular as they were, we probably would have bought a bit more strategic thinking into the naming of it. I mean, the Faux Fop one, I can't take any responsibility for. That was all Will. And I do find now that I know that we share the Faux Foppin' duties, I do find it kind of difficult, especially if I'm approaching someone who hasn't been on the show or isn't aware of Faux Fop or the podcast network, when I say, hey, do you want to come on my show, Faux Fop? Because it does not give it, like, even if you say 20th century digital boy, like, you know, 20th century boy, like they understand Harry Potter and the Boys. Like, you know, I can guess, oh, it's about pop culture or it's about Harry Potter. Whereas Faux Fop is like, what is this? It does not.
I'm actually pretty sure, don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure, is it Gareth Reynolds who often goes on Faux Fop as a guest of Will? And I often edit Will's Faux Fop, so they'll send me the files. I'm pretty sure Gareth labels his as Faux Fop. Oh. Like, he thinks he's on Faux Fop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he labels his file as Faux Fop Gareth. And I'm like, does he know it's not Faux Fop and it's Faux Fop? But yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, any time that we've done any kind of like official press release, you know, through a PR department or something like that, they always will write Faux Fop, then in brackets, 30-odd foot of pod, as if like that's going to enlighten anyone.
Explain it. Yeah. Oh, that's what it stands for.
Especially when they spell it numerically, like as in 30 odd foot of pod. It's even more confusing when they do it like that. So, I mean, Will and I have discussed many times, like maybe a brand repositioning or a renaming of the show. But I feel like
way too far in.
And I also like the idea, you know, like Saturday Night Live are really good at they'll do those sketches that go for ages and it starts off funny and then you're like, oh, they've beaten this to death. And then because they just keep pushing it, it becomes funny again. So I'm kind of hoping at some point it'll be funny. I mean, was it ever funny to begin with? Who knows? But maybe for Will and I, we will find it funny again at some point.
You could change what TOEFOP stands for to like the only fucking amazing podcast or something. That's a...
Well,
and that kind of that throws back to the that's awesome with Charlie Clausen, like just bizarrely spelt words. So you could change it to that.
Well, because Rusty did change. So it was originally 30-odd foot of grunts, and then he changed it to the ordinary fear of God. So that is possible. Oh, like we could be 30-odd foot.
The ordinary fear of pod.
The ordinary fear of pod, which is actually, I mean, that's a bit more enigmatic and interesting than 30-odd foot apart.
But I don't think it's more explanatory than 30-odd foot of pod. Like it's still confusing what it is.
I guess. Like I'm trying to think of similar, like Pod Save America. Like you kind of get that. Oh, it's a political podcast. I get that. The ordinary fear of pod. I wonder if you would think maybe it had some kind of religious implication or something like that.
Maybe it is kind of self-referential actually, because it's like because a lot of the stuff you guys do is just like kind of just, you know, two mates having a funny conversation, which is kind of the consensus of a lot of podcasts out there. So maybe it's an ironic title, like we're doing what everyone thinks a podcast is, the ordinary fear of pod.
Yeah, that makes sense. Could be that. I'll take that. It's very meta.
Yeah.
Speaking,
there we go, guys. That we've changed it.
Now, I've been following you recently on your socials, which everyone should check out. It's Radio Mike on, is that Twitter and Instagram, or is that that's
Twitter is It's Radio Mike and Instagram is radio.mike.
Radio.mike. And I saw you post something about Big Brother, which made me laugh, where you were talking about Big Brother's attempt to recreate the multiverse of madness by bringing back all their biggest stars. And your rant, which is very funny, I encourage everyone to go check it out, is this idea that they are, Big Brother are painting them as like, oh, these cultural icons are returning back to where it all started. And you're like, but they're not. Like people have barely thought about any of these people. And it got me thinking that like, hey, yes, you're 100% correct. But I was probably like into Big Brother maybe I missed the first season, the Reggie Bird season, and then I got into it maybe seasons 2, 3, and 4. That's probably kind of the where I was deep into Big Brother, but I have absolutely no idea who came after that. Were there any bigger stars after sort of like the Fitzy kind of era? Is there
you mean people who are now
like Chrissy Swan and Ryan Fitzgerald and like did anyone come after that initial say season 5 period that went on to be huge stars?
I know that not really. I know there's a woman called Constance Hall who was on Big Brother 2005, got evicted in the I loved that early Channel 10 Big Brother, by the way.
Yeah,
I
me could, too.
Like list trivia facts off the top of my head. Constance Hall got evicted, I think, first or second in Big Brother 2005. She's now like I don't know what she is, but she's some kind of influencer.
Right.
And she did a radio show for a bit.
Okay.
She's like a columnist. She's the only one I can really think of.
Well, let's talk about some alum then. I'm keen to go back and test your knowledge. Okay, so do you remember Saxon?
Right.
Do you remember the blonde guy Saxon from season 2 or 3?
I remember the name Saxon. He's not the guy who had the really weird haircut.
No.
Like the really weird, no. Okay, I do remember Saxon.
Well, there's just a little bit of vaguely. Trivia about Saxon is Saxon was a complete sound-alike for Will Anderson. They had the same voice. Oh. Like even Will acknowledged at the time that this guy's Saxon. So he didn't really have a very distinct character. He wasn't like, you know, the wacky one or the mean one or anything like that. He was kind of fairly generic. He was private schoolboy-ish blonde guy from Sydney, I think around season 2 or 3. But he sounded like he had the same high-pitched voice and tone as Will. It was really, really, really odd. And then I think the season that I got most into, and I was actually talking about this with friends when I was in Melbourne, I showed them your video, it was the second or the third season where is that FHM kind of Maxim model Jo Ashton came in. She was the blonde one, the sort of blonde sure, boxing one. Yep. And there was a guy called Vince, an Italian guy, who was in love with her. And it was like the best cringe television, the first few episodes when all the housemates were introduced, because Vince just like honed in on this girl and was like just trying all these lines. And there's this amazing exchange that is burnt into my memory where, you know, like the first night all the housemates are in there, they're having drinks and stuff and they're getting to know each other.
Mm.
And he just like hits on her big time, but takes himself super seriously and, you know, was trying to sort of create this image of being like this super enigmatic kind of dude. And he's sitting with her and he's like, you know, have you ever heard of Aphrodite? And she's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm filming with her. So she's the goddess of love, famed for being one of the most beautiful women of all time. And you, I think, are Aphrodite.
Terrible flirt.
Oh, terrible like, flirt.
Would never work.
I think this guy actually, I think he got a fair way down the line. Like he got evicted about halfway through. But I remember because I was living in Melbourne at the time and this was sort of really at the height of Big Brother kind of celebrity. And he came out and he got like a bunch of endorsement deals. I think he became like a model for, is it like Tarot Cash? One of those kind of like mid-level kind of menswear brands and stuff. You'd go down like Swanson Street in Melbourne and you'd see like him, like a big poster of him outside the store.
Mm. I see. Yeah. And the point I was trying to make in the video is like, I compared it to, and spoilers for Spider-Man No Way Home. Like I compared it to the three Spider-Men all appearing, right? Huge moment in pop culture. And I said like Channel 7 wants you to think that Trevor and Reggie standing next to each other is as big a cultural moment as Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and Tom Holland all appearing on screen together, right? And it's absolutely not in any way because we haven't thought about Trevor.
Yeah.
Nothing against Trevor. I'm sure he's a wonderful guy, but we haven't thought about him since 2004 or whatever.
And that's
right.
And that's because of the way Australia votes, because there was a period of time post Reggie or post Sarah Marie. Was she the first winner, Sarah Marie? Or no, Reggie?
She was season one.
Yeah,
but she didn't win that season. I think Reggie was actually season three.
Okay, right. So there was a period of time in which, like Trevor and this other guy Pete, they were just the most. It was like the way Australians, you know, elect politicians. It was the most boring, generic men you could think of. They were almost like if their strategy was fly under the radar, then they were underground under the radar. They were just so. Like, name me one defining characteristic of Trevor.
He proposed to his girlfriend when he won $1 million. That's the only thing I remember about him.
The thing I remember about Peter is that he looked after his little brother and his little brother ran up and gave him a hug in the final episode. But that was his defining characteristic.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because he had a brother.
Yeah, because that's even my favorite Big Brother moment of all time was the Logan twins.
Oh, yeah, that was
in
good.
Big Brother 2005. So, great twist, the Logan twins, identical twins, and they had to pretend they were one person. I think they were swapping every day. It all came down when one of them smashed into a window playing soccer and cut his arm open, and then the other one had to have a bandage on, and they kept saying, show us the scab, and he couldn't show them that there was any wound there, and that's how it all unraveled. Now, kind of for the same reason, one of the Logan twins ended up winning, but I just feel like it was because he was just sort of the nicest, most everyday guy in there and didn't really cause any trouble.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, too, the mentality around, like, voting out the most interesting people. Like, you know, all the ones who create all the drama and the intrigue and stuff, they're the ones. And it's like, I think if you've got any, you know, idea about, like, storytelling, you're like, no, you idiots, like, stop voting out the antagonists. You got to keep them in.
Yeah. And I think that's why now on Channel 7, it's like, well, one, I think the Big Brother format doesn't really suit the TV landscape of today. Like the original idea was it's just fly on the wall.
Yep.
You watch these people. We edit the best moments of the day, right? Now that doesn't really fit TV. But I also think like...
Well, I would argue that after, say, season two or three, that went out the window, because the beauty of the earlier seasons is that no one really knew how big this celebrity was going to get. But once people started to contestants started to connect the dots that, oh, this is a great way to launch a media career or a TV career, then it became much more contrived. Like you could sense that people were coming on to, you know, become a Maxim cover girl or to get that hosting job or radio gig or whatever it is. And then it just became less fun.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of what MAFS is now, right? Like everyone on MAFS tries to become an influencer after the season. They maybe get like 2 or 3 years of brand deals on Instagram. And then it's definitely not a long-term solution, I wouldn't think, for you to make a consistent income to go on MAFS and do brand deals for like makeup brands. But I don't know. I guess if people want to do that, that's fine. But yeah, I think like Big Brother, as you said, like it's all just people who want to be famous. They're not particularly interesting people, but they're like, yeah, I'll go on this show and do what they tell me to do. And then that's why I think they've moved away from the audience voting system. So now the producers can just kind of contrive the whole thing and write it as a storyline. Because the producers, as much as they had control, I guess, in the original, they couldn't control what the audience voted. So if the highlight that was giving them all the gold nuggets gets evicted, they're kind of just stuffed, and then they have to try and manufacture drama from there.
Yeah, but then they always had the get out of jail card, which is like, yeah, someone gets voted out, but then they can reintroduce them as an intruder or something like that. Once they figure out, oh yeah, we'll just wait 2 weeks and then put them back in the show. I got it's funny. Like, how do you think you would have gone in Big Brother? Like, is it something that you would be interested in attempting, like a show like Big Brother, Hidden Camera, Be Yourself kind of reality show?
I'd surely win. I'm so quirky. I actually think I'd win.
Do you really?
I reckon I'd win. I'm quirky and strategic. I reckon Australia would love me. I actually do.
I reckon I'd do pretty well as well. I mean, look, you and I are both kind of generic white guys, so maybe you're just on the basis of that would fly under the radar. But I've always said, I'd be interested to do Big Brother if it wasn't televised. Like if it was just like a kind of 6-week experiment where you could go, what, 3-month experiment, whatever it is, or I could just go into a house because it's the idea of like you've got no, you know, you've got no stimulation, no books, no screens, you know, you can't write and that kind of stuff. I'm like, oh God, like that's a huge part of my day. But I also would be interested to know, like to get the tapes afterwards and go back and not only observe my own behavior, because there would be a point at which you would forget about the cameras, but also the way other people react to me. Like it's the closest thing you'd have to sort of being invisible is to get the tapes of your 3 months on Big Brother and see.
Reading someone's thoughts.
Yeah, but also seeing the way other people, like you, the way you in the moment assessed a situation and then seeing the way the people break it down afterwards. It's like you think you've, you know, totally gone and charmed this group, and then as soon as you leave the room, they're like, fuck that guy, we're going to vote him out.
Saying you're a dickhead.
The next eviction. I mean, I would be, if the tapes only went to me, I think I'd be tempted to go into the Big Brother house.
Nah, I wouldn't want to ever watch it back. I wouldn't want to know what anyone thought. I think the worst thing that can happen, and no offense if anyone listening has had this happen, is you go into Big Brother and you're evicted first. I think that's the ultimate, like, sledge that you made the worst impression both on the public and on the people in the house.
Yeah.
That must be the worst feeling.
Well, it's similar to when, I remember when I started out acting, I did this acting workshop, and it was this lady, this American actress. I think she was like, I mean, her claim to fame was she did some soap opera in America, like, you know, 20 years earlier or something like that. But she was running this like little workshop.
Yeah.
And one of the first exercises she had us do was we were sitting around, like 10 of us in this group, and we had to look around the group and write down 3 things that you would cast that person as just from looking at them, which, you know, it's fine if all those stereotypes are okay. Like mine were all, you know, cop, lawyer, you know, principal, like just all kind of bland vanilla kind of occupations. But for some people, it was like this one guy, it was like criminal, rapist, deviant, and for another girl,
it was
like bimbo, trophy wife. Like, and it's just like, oh man, I don't know that this is a very helpful guide to anything.
Yeah, that's, and that kind of, that's sort of really sad because it's also undeniable. Like, this is what people think you look like just on first impressions.
Yeah.
Like, that would be really hard to hear, I think.
Well, the idea behind it was the teacher's theory was, oh, so when you go into a casting, you've got to know this is how you're perceived.
Your
so
niche.
This is either what you're leaning into or what you're fighting against, which... I mean, I do always wonder that when you see like casting briefs go out for, you know, it's just one scene in a TV show or a movie where it's like, you are the most horrible person in the world. It's like, which actor's putting their hand up for that? Like, or, you know, some agents like, oh, disgusting rapist. Oh, I've got five guys who I think I can put up for that role. Let's send the casting brief out.
Imagine that phone call as well, like from agent to client, like, hey, mate, yeah, we're casting for... like serial killer, pedophile kind of vibe. I think you'd be really good for it. Work's pretty scarce at the moment. You should put your hand up for it.
I think
that's horrible.
I think if you get cast as that once, that's fine. It's when you get known as that, when it becomes like, oh, we can think of no other actor.
When you're typecast.
But you to play this character, then it gets really, really challenging.
But I think there's lots of movies I've seen where I do think, who would have been like, why would you have accepted this role? Like, what was the process of you deciding that you were going to do this? Like, for example, have you ever seen the movie or heard of the movie The Human Centipede?
Yeah.
Do you know what it's about? The ass to mouth.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
yes.
when when your agent rings you and goes, hey, mate, there's this role going up. It's about you'd be a doctor, a psychopathic doctor who wants to surgically stitch three people together, ass to mouth, and turn them into like your own little pet. You'd be great for that.
I mean,
that sounds like a good opportunity for me in my career.
The doctor part is fine. I would take the doctor part. It's the people who are getting sewn ass to mouth that you go like, what actor took that role on thinking, well, this will be what launches me to the next level. I mean, horror movies traditionally are great launching pads for big stars. Like, there's a lot of actors who have got their start in horror films because horror films, you know, the genre means you don't need to be a star. Like, it's the genre that sells the film. So, you know, low budget and a lot of actors need to cut their teeth somewhere. And so that makes sense. But I think there is a line where it's like, well, the guy in American Pie, Jason Biggs, who fucked the pie.
Yeah.
Like, he's a good actor and good, fine comedian and stuff, but he was forever the pie fucker. And I think that has to be a consideration when you take that role on. It's like, oh boy, I can do this. And, you know, that was a funny script and, you know, obviously did really well, but there must be a point where you're like, I do this and I'm only ever going to be known as one thing for the rest of my life. And you see some actors embrace that. Like, I think Jason Biggs has a pretty good sense of humor about that. I've seen him, you know, he's done some Kevin Smith films where he's made fun of that. And I've seen him in interviews where he sort of, you know, acknowledges that. But then you get the other side, which is like the, you know, the Jake Lloyds, the Anakin Skywalkers who are just like,
that's a sad story about Jake Lloyd.
I didn't know anything about that until a couple months ago. And it's like that poor kid. And that's another thing where it's like, you know, when people ask, would Iona ever become an actor? I'm like, Iona can get into acting when she's an adult. Like, I think it should be like driving a car or drinking or anything like that. You can't possibly make those decisions as a child. Because when you're on set as well, like the natural order of things is inverted. You know, like in normal society, children listen to adults and they look to adults for guidance and they have very little power. But then on set, suddenly this like 8-year-old has someone bringing them things. They have assistants. They have people listen to what they have to say. And in your 8-year-old mind, that would be unless you have a really good, you know, family and support network around you. But otherwise, it would just put a child's mind. You know, it would just flip it on itself because all of a sudden they're like, oh wow. This is how I should be treated. I am important and people do need to listen to what I say. And, you know, I need to have someone bring me something to drink and bring me something to eat and all that kind of stuff.
And the other thing with the Jake Lloyd role in Phantom Menace is like, when you think about it, what parent would say no to that? Like, that role was must have been such a big casting role. And it's like, this is the boy Darth Vader. Like, this is the biggest, most anticipated film of the 21st century, essentially. And like, yeah, if your parents are like, hey, our kid could be in Star Wars, be the one of the main characters in Star Wars, of course, if you were like a show parent, you'd be like, yeah, he's doing it. And it ended up ruining his life. The reason I brought up Human Centipede, actually, now that you mention it, is I listened to this podcast, right? And it was an interview with one of the women who was the middle of the centipede.
Oh, right.
And I might link it to you. I think you'd find it interesting because they asked her all these questions. Yeah. They were like, why did you do it? Like, what was it about this movie that was interesting? And how did people react? And she said, oh, I just honestly like thought it was like a really interesting horror concept. I wanted to do indie films. And after I did it, so many people, including like a lot of my friends and parents, just like hated me because they just couldn't understand why I did this movie. And people started distancing themselves from her. And it like, and she doesn't say it ruined her life, but she's just like, yeah, it just, it kind of like impacted my career a lot and it ruined my relationship with my parents. And I think that's really sad. But at the same time, I wouldn't do that movie if someone like posed it to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. It's difficult.
Well, that actress from Peacemaker, what's her name? She plays Harcourt, Jennifer Holland. She's James Gunn's girlfriend. And she's really good in Peacemaker. And I had never heard of her. And so I looked her up after I watched the series because I'm like, what's she done? And then I looked through her catalog and her entire like first 10 years is all like B-grade schlocky films like that, you know, zombie strippers and all that kind of stuff. And I read this interview with her and she said that when she arrived in Hollywood, she just was like, I just don't know anything. I don't know, don't have any contacts here. I don't know how to get started. So yeah, if someone's offering to pay me to do this, I'll do whatever job is going. And she was able to kind of like, I think obviously because she's talented as well, but she was able to kind of like navigate her way through from that world into now doing mainstream films. I mean, James Gunn himself did that as well. Like he started off as a trauma director, making like, you know, just like the trashiest, weirdest kind of gross out kind of movies, and has shifted into the mainstream. So I guess I don't know if the director from Human Centipede has gone on to more mainstream.
He did two more Human Centipede films, each one more disturbing than the last. I've seen them all.
Oh, really? I've never actually seen the films. Are they just gross out movies, or is there something redeeming about them?
I actually think the first one, like, and take my words with a grain of salt, but I think the first one is a pretty like disturbing horror movie, right? That I think if you were really into horror and like gory kind of disturbing movies, I think it could pass as like a decent film. But then from there, it's just like, it basically becomes how many people can we stitch together ass to mouth and how many people can we like murder in that formation? And I think the last one ends with like a 900 people human centipede in a prison. So it's like, it just gets more and more bizarre. I don't think the director, whose name is Tom Six, has gone on to direct any more films from there.
I mean,
but he could have.
That genre of movie, especially in horror, like that kind of body horror, torture porn, you know, sort of after Saw, you know, torture porn got really popular again for a while with movies like Hostel and stuff. But that doesn't really bother me because I know that I can watch Jackass and see real gross out stuff. And like we just watched the latest Jackass film on the weekend, and there were whole sections which I just had my eyes closed. Like anything to do with like vomiting or poo or anything like that. Like I just like the vomiting stuff, I even listening to it because we were fast forwarding, but you know, we had both had our eyes closed and we just sort of skip it. But then you'd hear retching. I'm like, oh no, I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it. Like that stuff to me is like way more disturbing. Gets more of a visceral reaction. Like even Johnny Knox, have you seen the new one?
I have never seen any Jackass. Oh, right. Like I know they're what really it good. Is. I think it was a bit after my time. But yeah, I'd like to watch the new one.
Yeah, well, it's probably been like in the era now of like TikTok and stuff, like, and everyone does Jackass stunts. It's probably like not as groundbreaking, but at the time, like I was thinking about it the other day, every year that there's a new Jackass film or whatever spin-off series or whatever, there's always some think piece in like a reputable New York Times or whatever, where it's like masculinity in the modern age and Jackass. And it's like, stop it. All right. Like they say it themselves. This is not to be broken down and intellectualized. It is just about guys getting hit in the balls with things. And that's why you're watching it. There is a like a really strong element of creativity to it. Like Spike Jones is involved in it and they do have a point to it and they are creative in the way they execute the stunts. But it, generally it's about like watching people do silly things, like getting hit in the face with things. But this latest one, they do this vomit thing. They get on like a Gravitron type thing. They all drink a pint of milk. And it's like, I just can't sit through that. I don't think it's funny.
I don't like that stuff either. It actually reminds me of what you just said. Reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons. Have you seen much Simpsons?
Not new stuff. No.
Like it's a really old ep where there's the film festival in Springfield.
Man gets hit in the groin with football.
Yeah, and Homer just can't decide whether Barney's like heartfelt art house film about his alcoholism or man getting hit by football is better, because and he quotes, Barney's film had heart, but man getting hit by football had man getting hit by football. So it's really hard to decide. And I think, yeah, there is something appealing about like the concept of Jackass to me, like just watching a bunch of guys doing really crazy dumb stuff and getting hurt, like it's just some human thing of wanting to see that.
And it's also like, you've seen Idiocracy, right, where in the future 3000 in the future, the number one film is Ow My Ball. Oh no, the number one TV show is Ow My Balls. And I think the number one movie is just Ass, which is just like 3 hours of an ass farting on screen or something like that. I reckon they nail it, which is, I mean, the smart dumb, isn't there? There's dumb dumb and there's smart dumb, like the Logan Paul kind of phenomena on YouTube, those kind of stunts, I just could not get into, because it felt like Jackass, but without the kind of creativity behind it. Like you sort of felt with Jackass, there was an element of they're either being subversive or they're just, you know, the execution of the stunt is really funny. Like there's a great one where they had Brad Pitt come guest star on the TV series. And so they kidnap Brad Pitt. He's like lining up outside an ATM or I think it's a movie theater. And you just see this van pull up and a bunch of guys in gorilla outfits just jump out and like kidnap Brad Pitt. And like people like the general public trying to fight them off and stuff. And
then my God.
Later on in the episode, you see these all the guys in the gorilla suits go rampaging through downtown LA. They're just like running down, knocking signs and holding up traffic and stuff. And then the reveal at the end is they pull off the masks and one of the gorillas is Brad Pitt. And it's like, okay, cool. That's that's like planting and payoff. I really like it. But then you sort of see like the Logan Paul era and it's just like, oh, this is just annoying for the sake of being annoying. And maybe it's a generational thing, but I'm like, oh, I miss the old days of Jackass where there was a point to things.
Interestingly, have you seen or do you know of Mr. Beast?
No.
A YouTuber named Mr. Beast? Oh, okay. You might like him because Mr. Beast, I reckon, is sort of spearheading the future of what online entertainment is. So he started off just like he's younger than me, this young YouTuber kind of guy, and now he just makes so much money that he just does these stunts like he for example, when Squid Game came out, he recreated Squid Game with like 100 people and said whoever's last, like obviously no one got murdered, but he's like, I'm recreating, non-lethal. I'm recreating all the games in Squid Game with full sets and everything. And whoever's the last person wins $1 million.
Wow.
And he's like given away houses. Like he buys houses and then runs competitions. He's like, he's done stuff like the last person to leave this room wins a house.
Right.
And there's like, he gets 100 people, puts them all in a room and does a bunch of like stunts on them. And it's like, whenever you want to leave, you can leave. And then he bribes them by saying like, if you leave right now, I'll give you $50,000.
Right.
And then he like, because he has so much money, he just can create these amazing games. And I've seen a bit of his stuff, and it's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the first three hits. $10,000 every day you survive prison. Would you swim with the shark for $100,000? Yeah. And then there's the Squid Game in real life. But what was he doing prior? Oh, my God, he's had 15.3 billion views, 23 billion combined.
Yeah, I think he's the biggest YouTube. I think he's the biggest YouTuber in the world at the moment.
94 million subscribers, 164. They're the kind of numbers that streaming services just can't compete with, right?
Ever get. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why there's just, that's why he can give away $10,000 a day for someone to stay in prison or something like that and turns it into like really interesting, well-edited content. I don't know what he was doing before he got really loaded. I guess he was just doing like pranks or sketch kind of videos.
Man, I was thinking about this the other day about where celebrity is going, and you know, in the same way that you know your parents don't know when you're a teenager and you're into some band or some actor or whatever, and your parents don't know who they are. Like that's happening now. Like I for sure,
yeah,
because it's not only a medium. It's not just personalities that I'm not familiar with, but it's a medium I'm unfamiliar with. Like I know YouTubers, I know some YouTubers, but I do not know the YouTubers, like the these huge, like multi-billion-dollar industries.
Yeah.
Like Gem and I found this, like we were looking up how to exploit our child by making her a YouTuber. We found like there's this Russian girl and her dad. What are they called, Gem? You remember that what that kid's called? What? That Russian kid who does that YouTube videos? Oh, no. All right. So this Russian girl and her dad, they just make these like 5-minute YouTube videos where it's like we go to a water park for a day. And so it's like really cheaply shot with some sort of crappy bits of animation. And the essential premise is like the dad's a dopey dad and he's hanging out with his daughter and they just have fun, but they get like hundreds and Nastia, yeah, that's right, and it's just, but it's terrible. Like it's the most poorly produced, but it must be like just catnip for kids, and it is like kid friendly content. But this kid is slinging everything from like toys to clothing brands to sleepwear to whatever. She's like this multi-million-dollar empire.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting as well, and I think the thing about YouTube that I find very interesting is the fact that like there are probably pockets of YouTube that exist that you'll just never stumble across, but there is an active community and money being made in those communities. Like I watch so many YouTube channels about Nintendo, right? Because it's just like, I love Nintendo, and there are so many YouTube channels. My whole recommendation feed is like, people talking about Nintendo, that they're just videos that you will never see and will never be recommended to you, but they're getting hundreds of thousands of views, and it's just, there's such a dispersion of fandom now, whereas like I guess maybe when you were growing up and even when I was growing up, it was just like what's on TV is what's on TV. Like I remember we used to come to school on a Thursday morning and we'd all talk about Thank God You're Here, because that was just on Channel 10 on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And that was like the only thing people would talk about. But now it's there's so many things and so many communities that you can just be a part of online.
It's the greatest thing in the world, not just like from an entertainment point of view, but you know, if I need to do any housework, any like repairs or anything like that, oh, there'll be a YouTube video for this. And there is, like no matter how niche it is, you type in the product, the serial code of the product, and you'll put it in and you'll get someone to say, oh, this is where the bolt is located. This is how you undo it. And it's like, how did people do anything before we had this kind of spoon fed to us?
Oh, I remember when I was growing up and I used to play like video games all the time. If you got stuck, this is before YouTube. If you got stuck in a video game, there were people who had done like 1,000-word walkthroughs of a game. So they had just typed up, then you do this and you go here and do this and you have to do this, right? So you would look it up and you would follow it along and you'd play, while you were playing the game, you'd follow this walkthrough someone had written and you'd try to make sense of what they were saying in their text. Now, someone's literally made a 2-minute clip of the exact part of the game that you're stuck on. And it's just like, you just do this and you're like, ah. And it kind of like, in some ways, I'm like, am I just sort of cheating?
Yeah.
Should I be trying to figure this out? But I've been stuck on it for half an hour and I'm sick of this part of the game.
Oh, it's ruining our brains. It's definitely ruining our imaginations. Mm. I just read this novel, this sci-fi novel that I really enjoyed, but I needed to know more info about it. I was like, so the premise is, it's called Clara and the Sun. It's by the same author who wrote Never Let Me Go. And so it's about AI.
Very giant?
No, it's about AI.
I just thought, I think that author wrote a book called The Buried Giant.
Yes. Yes, as well. That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And the AI, like, it's very, they give you minimal amounts of information, specific information in the book, because it's all from the AI's perspective. So you don't really know even what she physically looks like. Is she, like, you know, indistinguishable from humans? Is she identifiable as an android? All this kind of stuff. And then there's also, like, it took me 7 or 8 chapters to, I was getting so frustrated because every time this AI would, you know, she would talk about, like, you know, walking into a room and there's boxes here and there's, and I'm like, what are these boxes in the future? Like, why is everything in boxes? And then it took me like 8 chapters to realize that was like her interface. Like, she's describing when she walks into a room, like she has multiple screens.
Everything scanning.
Yeah, popping up. Yeah. So she's like, you know, zooming in on someone's eyes, but she's also got like a camera over here. So I'm like, oh, man. Yeah, and then
that's,
I'm like,
so clever.
And I'm like, what else am I missing out on? And so I put in like Clara and the Sun, and there was no YouTube video on it. There's just a bunch of reviews. I'm like, no, someone must have, there must be some concept art or something so I can see what she looks like. Breakdown.
Clara and the Sun breakdown and Easter eggs you may have missed.
Yes, I needed
everything you missed in Clara and the Sun.
Yeah, I needed a big red arrow video that I could watch so someone could say, oh, yeah, there's all these things you missed.
After every Marvel movie, there's like 100 videos of like every single thing you missed and some guy freeze framing every 5 seconds and be like, oh, well, actually, this cloud actually looks like this character from this comic book in 1984. And it's like, I don't know, just the amount of effort people put into this stuff.
And the turnaround, like a trailer will come out and then within, you know, less than 12 hours, there is a breakdown Easter egg video, and it's like, how did you research and get all this information out? Like, this is the trailer goes for 2 minutes and you've released a 15-minute video breaking down every single frame.
Yeah, there's this YouTube channel I watch, going back to Nintendo there, and they got really big for doing what they called analysis videos of game trailers that would come out. There was this big game, it's a really good game called The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. So that came out a few years ago. There was a 30-second teaser trailer that came out for it, and this guy made a 3-hour YouTube analysis video, and people were like, nah, this is just excessive. There is not that much to talk about in it. But yeah, I really like that what you just said about the writing in Clara and the Sun, because one of my favorite pieces of writing of all time in a novel, which is, have you ever read this book? It's a kid's book, but it's called The Giver by Lois Lowry.
No.
Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay, so it's a really good book. It's a science fiction kind of dystopian novel about this boy that lives in this like super communist society where the government has essentially controlled people so much that people can no longer see color.
Right.
So people see in black and white now. And,
how is that possible? Is that a physical transformation or
it's never really explained. Okay. It's a little bit supernatural and you have to kind of like suspend your disbelief, but you don't know that they can't see color at first. And then the way you find out is because the main character starts seeing color, right? And he's playing with one of his friends and they're throwing an apple back and forth. And the writing just says, oh, for a split second in midair, the apple changed and the character's name's Jonas. And it's like, Jonas couldn't explain how the apple changed. There was just a split second where the apple completely changed and he couldn't understand what had happened.
So it's color for the first time. He's seeing color for the first time.
Yeah, and then, exactly. And then as the book continues, more and more red things start changing, and then you realize that he's seeing the color red for the first time. Right. And I just thought it was similar to what you've just described. It was just a really interesting way of, rather than just saying, oh, he saw red, it was like, in the world of this book, he doesn't even know what that means or what that is. So it's just, you had to do the work as the reader.
Oh man, it's so much effort. You have to do the work as the reader.
Yeah. Like, yeah, so you, that's another one where you need a breakdown analysis video, but yeah.
Well, it's even like, I actually gave up on this book. I was reading this, because I Googled like hard sci-fi, like I want a really like, you know, hard sci-fi, but one where the science is really solid and stuff. And so there was this book.
Yeah.
Oh God, I completely forgot what it's called. Osemiosis, which is, it's this book. It's all about, it's told over different time periods about these colonists arriving on this kind of planet that has a similar kind of atmosphere to Earth. And so it's told from the perspective of the very first colonist, astronaut, to arrive there and, you know, what they're battling against. Okay. And then it jumps 100 years into the future where it's like the next generation of the colonists, and then it jumps 100 years after that. And so it really takes like a lot of your imagination, because they're like, the, you know, one character is a botanist and another character is another kind of scientist. And so, and they're all feeding you information about the flora and fauna of this planet. And once again, I'm like there are these little creatures called hippocats. And I'm like, but what is a hippocat? Like, I don't, because, you know, they're describing it as, you know, it's got fur and legs and eight eyes and whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not, this is not sticking in. Like, sometimes I have to read a chapter like three times before I can even. And so again, I was online. Yeah. It's like, has someone out there, like,
what does it look like?
Done some concept art, because I need someone to draw to draw it for me. But I couldn't find anything.
I did the exact same thing. Yeah, I did the exact same thing with, did you ever read Philip Pullman's Northern Lights trilogy?
Oh, yeah, I read the first. I read the first one. That's the one with the polar bear, the armored polar bears and shit, right? And the,
correct.
What are they called? Yeah. The little things that sit on your shoulder there.
The
demons.
Yeah, exactly. In the second book, they start traveling through different kind of multiverses, because what happens is you realize there's multiple parallel universes and they start jumping between them. And there's one world that's like inhabited by it, like elephant-like creatures who have a single wheel for a leg, like. So they're like elephant heads with wheels.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? What is this? And then eventually I'm like, I can't continue reading this unless I know what these creatures look like. So I Googled it. Thankfully, because I guess it's a well-known kids book, someone had done an illustration of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is really hard in fantasy and sci-fi worlds that are really dense when you just can't picture what's going on at all.
Yeah. But it's also because my brain has been rotted by YouTube for 15 years, like, and getting the answers. Like, it's just not used to having to visualize things. Like, it's got to the point now with certain kind of pop culture franchises and stuff like Star Wars and Marvel, which I've sort of checked out of a little bit. And, you know, like, especially Star Wars, I'm like, oh, I don't have the interest or the energy to keep up. But what I'm doing instead is I'm watching all these YouTube videos. Like, I watched one last night. I think it's a YouTube channel called Fandom. It's a spin-off of Screen Junkies.
Okay.
And so they basically I think it's called Cram It, where it's like, this is everything you need to know about this character. And so they did this one about Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so they literally start with, this is what Obi-Wan Kenobi was like in the original trilogy. This is what we saw in the prequels. This is the intervening Clone Wars. And this is what we're expecting will happen in the TV series. And it's like, oh, this is great. Like, I don't have to watch any of that shit again. Like, I've got a little cheat sheet. I understand. Yeah. Oh, this is, and they give you sort of like a deeper reading of the dynamics between his relationships with all the other characters. Okay, so him and Qui-Gon, he was assigned Qui-Gon because of this reason, and he and Qui-Gon didn't actually get along that well. And then his relationship with Anakin was more like this, but then by Clone Wars becomes like this. And it's like, okay, good. So if I do feel the need to dip my toe into this new Obi-Wan series, it's like, okay, well, I've just watched this cheat sheet. And now, and I reckon that even if I had gone back and watched all the Obi-Wan, you know, things he's featured in on my own, I would not have got that depth of reading on the character that I got from these videos.
Yeah. From some hardcore fan. Because I did notice that Disney Plus does have a thing that you can click on. It's like the Obi-Wan collection. And it's like all the movies and then all the episodes of the animated TV shows that they consider fundamental to Obi-Wan Kenobi's character, which is, when you think about it, basically like Obi-Wan, there's probably more information about the life of the fictional Jedi Obi-Wan Kenobi than most real world human beings.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, and it's just like Obi-Wan Kenobi is now essentially a sub franchise of Star Wars. Like, he's getting his own TV show, which I am actually very excited about. But I just think, yeah, there's literally people who are essentially historians on Star Wars, like on the fictional history of Star Wars. And I actually really like that because I'm a big fan of I'm a big fan of people who are big fans of stuff and people who really love stuff. That's why I think Hard Quiz is a really good show, because it's just, it celebrates people who are just obsessed with this one thing. And I'm a kind of person like that obsesses over small franchises that no one else really cares about.
Wasn't there a point though with Star Wars in which, because you know the whole expanded universe and the novels and stuff like that, where when it got bought by Disney, they were like, "Hang on, this stuff's no longer canon." Like they sort of cut off a whole section of Star Wars fandom. So who gets to decide what's officially canon and what's not?
Don't know. I think they've marked, like, all the books and novels, a lot of them they've called like Star Wars Legends. So they're like, they're not canon, but they're just like legends of the of the Star Wars universe. But I guess now just anything Disney owns and publishes is canon.
I mean, it does.
I guess before that, it was anything George Lucas did was considered canon.
I mean, it used to make me laugh, you know, that people would say a new Batman, Christopher Nolan's Batman movies come out after the Tim Burton ones, and there'd be a section of the audience would be like, "Oh, so is Jack Nicholson going to be in this?" And it's like, no. Like, they're starting again. But there is this, there's a lot of people who feel like all this stuff needs to be linked, because the big complaint about the X-Men universe is, it doesn't make sense chronologically, and you know, jumping around in the decades, and you know, if they were here in the 70s, then Wolverine must have been, you know, all this kind of shit. And I'm always like,
yeah,
who gives a fuck? Like, really? Like, especially when you're talking about the world of comic books, where a different writer and a different artist comes in on a run and they just take the story in any direction they want. Like, there was all these people complaining about Tom Hardy being the new Mad Max, and it's like, well, there's no Mel, there's no Max. It's like, well, first of all, Mel Gibson is like way too old for you to do any stories about young Max. And second of all, he's a pretty horrible person. Like, I don't think it's bad to recast that specific role.
Recast.
But but this idea that, you know, you're going to explore the universe, and it is stuff of legend. Like, you're talking about, you know, Star Wars legends and what is canon, what is not. Well, it's all legend. Like you say, they're all fictional characters.
It's all
so if you want to do a version of Mad Max where it's let's go back into, you know, a younger Max, then it makes complete sense. Like, the idea that you have to only use the same cast, which I reckon is one of my big issues, the big obstacle I have with getting into any of these kind of like expanded universes or reboots, is that I don't give a fuck about the paying, you know, the nostalgia stuff and, you know, bringing out the old, I don't care. Just tell a good story. Yeah. Like, I don't need all those nods. And like, I think we talked about this last time you're on, but I finally saw the new Ghostbusters and it just bugged the shit out of me. I just fucking hated.
Yeah. You talked about it on Tofop.
Oh, was it Tofop?
You talked about it on Tofop.
Yeah. I just got the, everything that was made the original film so great, it just completely misunderstood. And like, I just don't need to see all these kind of like reverential, worshipy, you know, shots of like the proton packs and Ecto-1. It's like, that's not the film, you idiots. Like, it's not that at all. And I understand that they're rebranding it for a Stranger Things generation and all that kind of stuff. But I just sort of feel like, just make something different. Just, you know, take the lessons of Ghostbusters and make something different. Like, it's not like horror comedy or ghost comedies and, you know, ghost kids films haven't been made before. Just stop relying on the brand recognition to sell your shitty movie.
And did you see the new trailer for Jurassic World Dominion? Because I thought of you as soon as I saw it.
I can't remember. Because is that the one that Sam Neill's back?
Yeah, Sam Neill's back. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, oh, Charlie would surely hate this. Because I thought the whole point of doing the new ones and Chris Pratt was in it is like, no, none of the original characters are in it. It's kind of like a reboot. There's maybe a couple references to the original, but now they're going out with a bang and bringing back the original cast and the new cast together. And I just think it looks really dumb to me, but I guess that's how everyone feels about all the stuff that I like when they do that.
Well, there was a period of time, you know, after the 70s in which Kiss just were a band with no makeup and no costumes. They were just a rock and roll band. And then something happened around, like, I think it was sort of the mid-90s where, you know, they decided to put the makeup back on and the costumes back on. Everyone was like, cool, Kiss are back. And then, like, they get older and heavier and it's like, you know, the costumes are expanding and the makeup's sort of hanging a bit low on the face and stuff like that. And
yeah,
after a while, you're just like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to see Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels in the Dumb and Dumber outfits, but only 30 years older. It looks fucking weird. Like, it just looks weird. Don't put them back in the, like, even with The Force Awakens, and you see Han Solo and everyone was like, oh my God, he's back. And it's like, Han Solo has not changed his wardrobe in 40 plus years. Is that what you're telling me? He's still wearing that black vest and that shirt? Like,
but that being said, they are space years, which might be different to Earth years. You can't be certain. Actually, I'm sure there is an article somewhere about how time in the Star Wars universe relates to our universe, but yeah, I mean, they are space years, Charlie. You can't be certain.
That is true. And like, that, who's to say there's maybe no department stores in space. It's not like he could just easily go out. Mm. Maybe he's just been repairing the same clothes for 40 plus years.
Yeah, possibly. He doesn't look like the kind of guy who bothers himself with going to shops and trying on clothes and stuff. But you never know.
I mean, there is this thing too, isn't it? Of like the suiting up moment in any kind of superhero or genre film is like the big exciting. You know, they put on the mask for the first time, or they put on their signature jacket or whatever. But now it's just got to the point where like everything's signature. It's like, oh, you know, what did he wear on his wrist, or what kind of boots did he had on? And it's just like, it's not all. I mean, I've been watching a lot of The Young Rock. I'm into the, I think it's the second season of that. And like, I think it's really fun. And it's just like, it's just your average sitcom that's sort of tricked up because it's all kind of like 80s nostalgia, WWF nostalgia. But they do this thing where, like, if you're a wrestling fan, they'll, you know, there'll be a scene where it's like, oh, there's like, you know, King Kong Bundy, or there's George the Animal Steel, or there's like a young Randy Savage or whatever. And it's kind of cool because, like, you know, they cast people who look like them and it's kind of fun to sort of see that interacting. But they can't help themselves. They'll stop the show and they'll bring up like a stats card and say, this is, hey, just in case you didn't get it, you fucking idiots, this guy is this wrestler and he won this many world titles. Yeah. And it's like, oh man, like I just would have liked it.
Subtlety.
Yeah, if you just let it play out, it's like, oh, they're just a character in the show rather than having to stop everything so we can acknowledge the fact that you're referencing something.
That's actually a great point. I just thought of another one in, I'm saying with certainty you haven't seen this movie, but in the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, you know, do you know the character Sonic the Hedgehog?
Yeah, he runs around grabbing rings or something. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He wears in the game. He wears red sneakers. Yeah. Like that's like an iconic part of his costume. And in the movie, he starts out wearing like some generic, like, you know, runner. And then halfway through the movie, someone's like, "Hey, Sonic, I bought you some new shoes." And he opens them up, and it's the trademark Sonic the Hedgehog red sneakers.
And everyone puts gasps. Them on
and there's that. Yeah, and there's the pan up shot from the feet up of, you know, look, this is, it is Sonic. Look, he's wearing the shoes and everything. And it's like, I don't know, he could have just had the shoes from the start. I'm not interested in how Sonic the Hedgehog got his shoes. I just want you to make like a movie about him. But anyway,
I did remember
they do have that in like every movie.
Charlie Cox, the actor who plays Daredevil, like he did an interview. It was a pretty funny where he's talking about how, because I think he's in No Way Home, the new Spider-Man. Is that right?
Yes,
he does a little cameo. He
briefly pops up. Yeah.
Spoiler alerts.
Yeah.
And he did this interview where his wife or his partner said, "Oh, we should go see No Way Home, because apparently like when you pop up, the crowd goes nuts." And so it's like, all right. And so they sneak in the back of a cinema and this scene happened and there's just dead silence in the audience. Just the most like humiliating experience. He sort of slinked out of the cinema straight after.
I remember because I didn't watch the Daredevil show on Netflix, which he's from.
Oh, yeah.
So when I saw No Way Home, like when Charlie Cox appears on screen, everyone was kind of like, oh, like gasping and stuff. But I had no idea that it was Daredevil from the Netflix show. So, yeah, so I was just like, okay, cool. This guy, I guess people know him or something. There's a similar moment in the Multiverse of Madness Doctor Strange movie. Have you seen that at all?
No. I actually, you know, it was funny. That's another one of those shows or movies where I'm not sure I'm going to see it, but I watched a 45-minute breakdown of it last night on Red Letter Media.
Yeah, so in that, John Krasinski pops up in a cameo role as Mr. Fantastic from a different universe. And, you know, apparently there was like some meme or some viral thing where people were saying he should play Mr. Fantastic in the new Fantastic Four. So it was like a big moment that he popped up for this cameo, but I had no idea about that. So I was just like, okay, they've just got some dude to play Mr. Fantastic, I guess, when everyone else was like, oh, they did it. And I just don't get it.
I did see someone online say that their favorite fan service moment in the Multiverse of Madness was when someone in the audience gasped when Doctor Strange put on the magic cloak that he's been wearing for the whole film and the whole series. Like, he put the cloak on.
I saw that too. It's like he's always had this from the first movie. This isn't even one of those reveals. Yeah, that's so good.
Mike.
And also, like, people gasping. Oh, sorry. No, I was just going to say, people gasping when Patrick Stewart pops up. It was like, well, we knew he was in it. He was in the trailer. That's not a surprise.
Was he
Don't
in the trailer?
Act like you're surprised that. Yeah, his voice and silhouette are very clearly like hinted towards in the trailer. And it's like, oh, Patrick Stewart's in it.
So there's one last thing I want to talk about before we go about Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah.
So explain to me this. So a couple of things that I've read about and heard about it is, so, you know, this is the film that, you know, breaks open the multiverse, but they only go to one or two alternate dimensions. Is that right? Yeah.
They only really go to one other dimension. Oh, yeah. I mean, realistically, there's one, and that's the one where a different version of Patrick Stewart's Dr. Xavier is the head of the Illuminati with Mr. Fantastic and several other cameo appearances from other minor Marvel TV shows and stuff. But yeah, they don't really, it's not like they're hopping between different multiverses and meeting all these different
characters.
Not
like Rick and Morty.
No, it's nothing like that. It is nothing like that.
Because I heard that criticism. I was like, oh, yeah, that's silly. And then I'm like, but every sci-fi film you think about when, you know, landing on an alien planet or fighting an alien planet or whatever like that, you only see the, you know, they land on a planet and it's only really the 20 or so people around where they land that they interact with. I mean, there is how many billion alien creatures on this planet or whatever, and you're only ever seeing this one small part of it. So it's like, I understand that's the criticism, but like you can't tell a story. You can't tell a story legitimately in any other way because there's no, unless it's going to be like an endless movie, and unless it's going to be the never-ending Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah, exactly. Have you seen Everything Everywhere All at Once?
No, I'm desperate to see that. I almost went to see it last week, but I'm dying to see that film.
Yeah. Well, I'd recommend that. Like, that's a lot more. Well, I won't spoil anything, but I think that's a really good, similar kind of concept to the Multiverse of Madness, I guess. And it's a cool sci-fi. And it's a good original film concept. So I really liked that movie.
I mean, I know I said that was going to be the last thing, but just this is one last thing. Benedict Cumberbatch, does his American accent bother you?
Not particularly. I sense it bothers you.
Yeah. It's just, he's got that accent of just like an English person doing an American accent where it's kind of like this. It's, I don't know. It's just, it doesn't sound a little artificial.
There is a
artificial.
Twang to it that's a bit weird.
I know. Yeah. I know. Something about it. I'm just like, I don't know. It's kind of like when you hear Ewan McGregor do an American accent. He just can't quite grab it.
Can't believe it. No. Yeah, yeah. No, definitely.
I'm
fine with it.
Mike, your podcast, 20th Century Boy and Harry Potter and the Boys, where can people find them?
If you go to my website is radiomike.com.au, so everything kind of feeds onto that.
There'll be a link in the episode description.
Or there's video. Thanks, mate. Yeah, and then, yeah, just type them in on whatever podcast app you use. And then I post a bunch of clips, as you said, on my Instagram, radio.mike, and TikTok, radio.mike. If anyone uses TikTok, feel free to follow there. But yeah, you can find all my stuff. My Harry Potter Pod is a fan fiction podcast that Charlie guested on, great read. We read out my fan fiction of Harry Potter that I wrote when I was about 13. And it's
a real insight into the mind of a young man.
Yeah, it is exactly that. So, you know, both come out weekly and yeah, they're pretty good, I guess.
No, they are. They're great. They're a lot of fun to listen to. I'll put links in the episode description. And you can also hear a podcast Mike/Radio Mike appearing on our show, TOEFOP. You can go to TOEFOP.com to check out all our great podcasts. But Mike, thanks for joining the show. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I am Podcast Mike.